So yesterday's talks are focused on the very important issue of embodiment and materiality vis-a-vis what is commonly known as intelligence. My interest in the debate is informed by a different perspective which aspires to link the ontology or the particular mode of being of the mind and the possibility of stretching the notion of materiality far enough so as to encompass the mind and yet not resort to reductivism or substance dualism. So I will very briefly outline what I think the problem is. Materialism and its air of scientificity carries with it the danger of disqualifying the entity that it sets to explain by allowing, if not exactly substance dualism, then another form of dualism which thrives on the distinction between fictional phenomena or experienced secondary qualities and real material properties or essences. So what really exists are connections, neural or otherwise, between things or stuff, and what is experienced as mind is a phenomenal quality somehow emerging from these material connections. That is to say that the properly scientific explanation of the mind frequently comes with a baggage of bifurcationist assumptions, also known as the two-world hypothesis. This type of materialist explanation hinges on being a very biased realism. In short, it runs the risk of pushing the mind outside the fully ontological dimension of the existent, or of rendering the mind merely a way of saying, a nominalist matter, a secondary quality in experience. But this literal disqualification of experience and what is given to it rests on the solipsism of a transcendental consciousness somehow standing outside experience and being able to judge whether something is a real property or a fictitious quality. In short, we are faced with the attempt to found experience in general and the experience of mentality in particular on a slip of consciousness, which creates another problem. How is science to accept first-person points of view if this is not, strictly speaking, material? What we have here is a fantastic situation according to which a transcendent consciousness presiding over experience can judge the fictitiousness of phenomena, but at the cost of this fictitiousness turning back on itself. So it is a consciousness of mentality telling itself that it is a phenomenon, if it makes sense, but qualifying at the same time as an objective scientific perspective. In other words, the scientific conception of the mind is based on the empirical, but this empirical is not exactly the experiential. So because the empirical is pre-owned by a subject. In short, what I'm trying to say is that experience primarily entails an openness that is uncapturable by the scientific empirical. And all this is to a large extent predicated upon a disentanglement of the logical from the experiential and hence the existential. In short, we need to somehow think of the ontology of logic as having an experiential quality. But the link between the logical and the experiential, first of all, has to begin with a different account of experience. And for that, I will turn to a philosopher that helps me think through this problem in a rather tantalizing way. And this is Charles Sanders Peirce. So Peirce's philosophical system assigns experience a rather complex position, one which is wide enough to incorporate logical inference, yet sufficiently subtle to bypass the classical deadlock of transcendental subjectivism and its nominalist assumptions. Indeed, in his phenomenology, he aims to analyze the structure of reality as experienced or appearing according to logical categories, but this phenomenology begins with a tension. On the one hand, he declares it to be the study of the collective total of all that is in any way or in any sense present to mind by simply scrutinizing direct appearances to combine minute accuracy with the broadest possible generalization. Yet this deceptive simplicity is soon disrupted by another declaration. Peirce has no intention of rendering his study into a what he calls fatally inapt psychological exercise from which to judge the reality or not of phenomena. Neither is his goal to establish a heuristic so that the observing mind can traverse the distance, the vertical distance, from finitude to generality or from the singulars of experience towards the universals of knowledge as the traditional method of induction would have it. So with Peirce, the problem of experience is already transformed. It has the paradoxical status of being at once the point of departure, but also the point of arrival of philosophical and scientific inquiry, because the givenness of the given in experience is something to be explained rather than explained away. So what is at stake is an immersion of logical inference within the qualitative richness of the phenomenon. And this is implicating the mind within hints of experience already inhering in and constructive of experience. Before considering how Peirce collapses the traditional distance between logic and experience, we need first to consider why such a conversion of transcendent universals as sense immanent in experience is necessary. Very briefly, the problem he seeks to supersede concerns the inability of classical methods of mediation, such as Humean induction or the Kantian deductive categories of understanding, to explain thinkings in terms other than a logical activity which adds, a posteriori, concepts to what is already given to the thinker in experience. The difficulty here lies in the fact that the passage from the singular to the universal is based on the problematic assumption that the given in experience comes in the forms of singulars in need of unification. This results either in nominalism, positing the fictional status of universals, or the necessity of postulating an exterior consciousness to piece them together in order to extract universals and then impose them back as concepts. In any case, though, the activity of thinking, or more precisely of reasoning in this context, is something that is already presupposed as a property of the subject. So the subject is already there to interpret experience from a bird's eye view, and the option it offers is the dichotomization of the singular from the universal, which in the hands of certain strands of eliminativism results in the bifurcation of nature, denying the reality of phenomenal experience. So, first of all, to be clear, inasmuch Peirce rejects what Sandra Rosenthal calls a spectator theory of knowledge, he does not suggest an interpretation-free approach to experience either. The subject, or the unifying mind, which also has political consciousness as the subject is an important constituent in the perceptual relation in terms of which the sensory given is constructed as a percept, as a taken. Yet insofar as the act of perception is a relation in terms of which the relative given appears as a perceptual fact, the subject-object dynamic can't be unilateral. There is no reason to suppose that my subjective relationship with singulars and experience only stems from me. So the subject, in other words, cannot be the natural and sole originator of perceptual experience. As he says, no unity can originate in concentration, but in any unity that was already there, this may be many times intensified. Subjectivity, then, is not presupposed, but it's mutually constituted through this relational activity. In short, it is something which stands to somebody in some respect or capacity. But what is there that may, through relation, be intensified? What is this dimension of the given singulars capable of warranting a restructuring of the philosophy of experience so that it can no longer emanate from, but be mutually constitutive of the subject? The answer, which has a double effect in its multiple, rather, effect in its epistemological and metaphysical reach, and which clears out a path for a properly pragmatist account of the relationship between the logical and the existential, is quality, or appearance. First of all, Peirce starts with the importance of the concrete reality of perceptual experience. And this entails a type of common sensism, asserting the existence of Coelia against their nominalist relegation into what he calls bad facts. Sensation, he writes, is requisite for the apprehension of sense quality, but no sensation or sense quality is requisite for the possibility, which is the being of quality. From this standpoint, phenomenal qualities such as color or sound or emotion or, I don't know, phenotypes maybe, are and can be apprehended by the mind, but their existence as such is not reducible to the relationality that brings them to being. So considered in itself, quality, phenomenal quality, becomes an ontological question. It is not anything, he writes, which is dependent upon mind, whether in the form of sense or thought. Nor is it dependent in its being upon the fact that some material thing possesses it. In short, quality is not just a side effect on top of a material and hence more properly and scientifically describable entity. A quality, he says, is mere abstract potentiality. Now, this abstract potentiality is one of, which also figures as firstness, is one of Peirce's most demanding aspects, but we need to, in order to understand how it affects the relationship between logical inference or formalism and experience, it is necessary that we linger on it for a while. So Peirce describes it as possibility in the first place, but he says that the word possibility fits it, except that it implies a relation to what exists. Whereas, well, universal firstness is the mode of being of itself. Hence, this is the reason why he uses potential instead. So indeed, for a theory which aspires to explain the genesis of universals and be realistic at the same time, I mean, if you want to say that universals, like phenomena, exist, possibility retains too much of a logically predetermined outlook to offer any genuine alternative to the problem of experience. I mean, what good is it to me if it returns the experiential process to a priori structures? Opting instead for potentiality allows Peirce to propose a material potentiality independently of whether it can be observed or not. And his most, let's say, famous, one of his most famous examples is one of a bar of iron, which if heated can bend, if not, it can stay as it is. But this doesn't mean that the bar of iron doesn't have the potential to become something else in a relation. So in this sense, quality actually exists as singular in a relation. Yet the being of quality as firstness is what may be, and it can be really, and not logically, said of every appearing thing, generally or universally. So in this sense, firstness as abstract potentiality is neither individual nor general, but it is by dint of its co-articulation, its co-emergence with every phenomenon, that experience acquires generality. And this is what gives firstness as abstract potentiality its peculiar character. We could relate it, in itself it is pure potential, but it only appears as possibility with the appearance of what it conditions. In short, when it is involved with the relationship of what Peirce calls a second, an existent, which is individual and actual in the literal sense. So starting from the problem of perception, Peirce is led to a conclusion which assumes primacy, although not priority in any kind, over its initial premises. Firstness as the non-given, as the ontological condition of experience, is an analytic element in it. More importantly, however, it allows Peirce to differentiate between perception and experience, and this is where the reference to the empirical versus the empirical comes from. If no phenomenon exists in isolation and each perceived quality actualizes firstness differently, it is this difference in variation in seconds, not like in time seconds, but in actual existing entities, which is properly speaking the object of experience. As he says, we perceive objects brought before us, but that which we experience is an event, a shock or change in perception. We experience vicissitudes especially. We cannot experience a vicissitude without experiencing the perception which undergoes the change. But the concept of experience is broader than that of perception. It is the compulsion, the absolute constraint upon us to think otherwise than we have been thinking that constitutes experience. There is an element of effort in experience, and this is what gives it its peculiar character. So by opening up experience, he renders it the sense of change, or as he calls it, the course of life. And it is this, in terms of this particular character, that experience becomes the terminus or the condition of thought, which is in no need of operating outside it, because experience is already teeming with universal by dint of the firstness that is imminent to it. So if thinking doesn't have to scramble together singulars into universals, this is because experience already has a sense which is singular and general at the same time, or, as we could say, as we could call it, pragmatically universal. It is with this move that Peirce's pragmatism acquires its proper tone. The universals in experience are not static and invariant, because the firstness that permeates them, their ontological condition, imposes no invariant cause of generality over the phenomena that actualize it. The being of quality is always already at variance itself. Its indeterminacy is not the indeterminacy of homogeneity. In short, there is no single homogeneous ontological condition underlying experience. Rather, he says, the first, or this ontological condition, is full of life and variety, which is there not definitely, but potentially and really. And so we're finally able to flesh out a series of implications this schema holds for the relationship, not only between the experiential and the logical, but also between reasoning and thinking. Because by appealing to the existence of a pragmatically universal sense within experience, Peirce is able to reconfigure it as actualizing an impersonal field, which is not the internal state of an organism. In short, experience is addressed before it becomes human, before it becomes the unity owned by a reflexive cognition. There is, though, and here I think I'm going to go into the shocking theories path, there is an even more promiscuous corollary to this. If everything in the world has a reality which is the quality of being both a first and a relational second, if everything is defined by its experiential contours and experience is the compulsion for thought, then everything can be said to have the potential for thought as experience. And he writes, I think that whatever is first is ipso facto sentient. Of course, this shouldn't be taken to entail that everything is capable of higher level of reasoning. This category he calls thirdness, but which is the category connecting first and seconds through rules or habits in the higher reasoning faculties of the mind. But thirdness or thought is possible only because the world itself is the process par excellence of reasoning in life. We can argue then that for Peirce, the subjective organized mind is not to be confused with thought. What is commonly referred to as intelligence is rather a determination of thought, that on account of its being a first is irreducible to its manifestations. So, along with experience as thought, and not thought as intelligence, there's a difference there, the problem of logic is also transformed. The rules of logical inference and concepts have their own being and their own reality, including every type of formalism, algorithms, information, and because of that, they are not immutable and transcendent, but variant and immanent to the things they correspond to. Because if firstness is the metaphysical condition allowing both for the ontological and epistemological genesis of pragmatic universals, the concepts cannot be somehow over and above singulars that are given in experience in a pre-existing space of variation. And also, contrary to other phenomenological strands, these singulars cannot be reduced to an instance of intensive variation internal to consciousness. There is already in the world the variational overlapping of phenomenal qualities themselves that creates new experiential cores of generality, new novelties that thought, that higher level reasoning follows and constructs at the same time. So by exposing logic to its metaphysical condition and stretching it onto experience, Peirce renders it properly experimental, and hence he seals its link with the existential. So although Peirce's logic is generally appreciated for its formalist rigor, which it is very rigorous, little attention is paid to the fact that the three categories I've just mentioned, firstness as abstract potential, secondness as relationality, and thirdness as connecting the two, are not of the Kantian a priori type. They are to be expected in the phaneron or in the phenomenon, but they must be experimented upon by experiential facts according to their consequences. So as epistemological categories, they are legislative for the analysis of phenomenon experience, yet from a metaphysical point of view, they also derive from experience and are always susceptible to the force of the experiment. But this, as Sandra Rosenthal points out, is not a vicious circle, but an exemplification of the cumulative process involved in the experimental interplay between meaning and experience. This is neither deduction from a priori postulates, nor induction from experience, but properly speaking, a process of what he calls abduction. It's the only type of reasoning, or being in reasoning, which is capable of novelty because it alone expresses spontaneous variant patterns of generality. In short, logic is a part of a scientific metaphysics that is pragmatic, and as such, its power, the power of logic, or its quality as abstract, concerns not simply its falsity or veracity, but primarily its consequences, the real phenomena it brings into existence by existing. A final word. Peirce is very well aware of the fact that such an ontology of logic and a metaphysics of thought, which is truly experiential, or if we were to adopt a Whiteheadian term, pan-experientialist, might already look distasteful to readers who would rather keep the properly formalist strand of his logic and just shrug at the rest. Against that, one could argue that what he calls quali-consciousness, the consciousness of qualities, is not the same as the cogito, and that his metaphysics is not of the animist strand. Yet there's also something else that needs to be marshaled as a response. What Peirce is offering by his pan-experientialist reading of thought is a truly pragmatic and hence deeply political response. And this response is directed to that class of objectors, as he calls them, so impressed with what they have read in popular books about the triumphs of science, that they really imagine that science has proved, and that's emphasis in original, that the universe is regulated by law down to every last detail. Or again, it is a response against that class of eliminativist materialists who insist upon drawing a line between reality and phenomenon. So, contrary to those who forget that scientific novelties of the abductive type, pan-experientialism for Peirce the chemist, because he was trained as a chemist, first of all appeals to the ability of an experiencing and experienced nature to generate novelty and not succumb to prescriptive and descriptive explanatory feats, as Whitehead says. The abductive logic of things, which is also the logic of the universe, is past mere utility. In other words, for Peirce, the world is coming into being by deducting, inducting, and abducting itself. And this is the ability of nature for novelty, which is connected with the ability of it being an open-ended process of determination, which in turn is connected to the ability of making new concepts. And this makes, politically at least, all the difference in the world. So it is a pragmatic ontology providing a field for a solution, but not its specification. For this can only happen with the event that takes place and not before or after it. That's it.
Well, thank you.